Radio Prague News.
The Foreign Minister has criticised Israeli settlement policy. Unemployment has fallen to a near five-year low. And in tennis, Lucie Shapovalova has entered the top 10 rankings. Czech Foreign Minister Lubomir Zaorálek has condemned Israel's continued policy of building settlements on land earmarked for the Palestinians. Zaorálek said that by persevering with the policy, Israel was torpedoing any chance of meaningful peace talks being revived. Building on land, for example, in East Jerusalem, gave the impression that Israel was not serious about restarting talks on the so-called two-state principle, he added. The comments were made ahead of a meeting with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu on Monday. Zaorálek is on a three-day trip to Israel and Palestine, which has included a trip to the Gaza Strip. The foreign minister said that he was shocked by the devastation following the bombardment and partial occupation by Israel forces in 2014 and the slow pace of rebuilding. The Czech foreign minister added sporadic rocket attacks from the Gaza Strip on Israel should cease. Separately, the Czech Republic and Israel have signed an agreement opening the way for young people from both countries to work for a year abroad without needing visas. The opportunity for working holidays will be open to those aged between 18 and 13. The Czech Republic already has similar agreements up and working with Canada and New Zealand. The unemployment rate in May dropped to 6.4% from April 6.7%, according to the Czech Labour Office on Monday. That means there are almost 466,000 registered for jobs without work, the lowest figure since June 2009. The number of vacancies stands at almost 93,000. That's the highest figure since November 2008. A year ago, the unemployment rate stood at 7.5%, with only half as many job vacancies being announced. In other economic news, the Czech Republic had a trade surplus in April of 19.9 billion crowns. That is around five times the 4.2 billion total for the same month in 2014. Exports of Czech companies rose by around 6% overall. The customary heavy import bill for imported oil, gas and some specialised chemicals continues to be cushioned by low prices for these raw materials. Overall, the Czech trade surplus with the rest of Europe increased, but the deficit with the rest of the world deepened. The Ministry of Finance has proposed that board and supervisory board members of almost 70% state-owned electricity producer ČEZ forgo their customary payments from profits. The proposal from the Ministry with regard to 2014 profits has been tabled for Friday's annual general meeting, with its passing a near certainty unless there is a change of mind. The payment proposed by the company to board members totals 25.5 million crowns. Payments allocated from profits to board members have been constant without interruption since 2001. And finally, the Czech Republic has, for the first time in a quarter of a century, two women tennis players in the singles top 10. Lucie Shapovalova has entered the WTA top 10 for the first time at number 7, following her success reaching the final of the French Open. Petra Kvitova jumps to second place due to the poor performance of high-ranked players at the Grand Slam tournament, but still trails number 1 Serena Williams by around 4,500 points. But top men's player Tomáš Berdych slips from 4th to 6th place. I'm Chris Johnston, and that was the news.
You are listening to Radio Prague, the international service of Czech radio, with me, Ruth Franková. Coming up in today's programme, Ludvík Vaculík, a prominent Czech writer and dissident, has died at the weekend at the age of 88. We have the roundup of the latest Czech sports news. And in one-on-one, we meet US academic David Cooper. He's an expert on two notorious 19th century Czech literary hoaxes and argues that their authors deserve credit rather than condemnation. All that coming up, so please stay with us. Ludwig Vaculík, writer, journalist and anti-communist dissident, died at the weekend at the age of 88. With his demise, the Czech Republic has lost one of its prominent post-war writers and a strong moral authority. Daniela Lazarová has the story.
News of Ludwig Vaculík's death dominated radio and TV news bulletins on Saturday, and the country's public broadcasters quickly changed their scheduled programs to pay tribute to one of the most respected personalities on the Czech cultural scene. We will all remember him as an important and brave man of pen and word, who was free and independent throughout his life and under any regime, the Czech Prime Minister Bohuslav Sobotka said in reaction to the news. Ludwig Vaculík's deep engagement in social and political affairs shaped his professional life. Two moments stand out. The first was Vaculík's critical speech at the 1967 Czechoslovak Writers' Congress, for which he was expelled from the Communist Party. A year later, Vaculík wrote the 2,000 words manifesto, a key document of the Prague Spring Reform Movement, and signed Charter 77. This ensured that he would not publish officially for the next 21 years. Yet he did not remain silent. He became publisher of the Samizdat series Edice Petlice that released hundreds of books by banned authors and one of the country's leading dissidents. I asked journalist and former dissident Jan Urban how he perceived the late writer.
I think that Ludwig was a symbol of his generation. He was a communist in his young years for 3 or 4 years. And all his life he tried to somehow pay for his mistakes, and he was one of the key personalities of the reformist movement in the 60s, then one of the key dissidents, always against injustice. I personally liked him a lot. Because albeit he was a provocateur, he had a wonderful human feeling for everybody, helpful to weak ones, and always targeting injustice.
Do you feel that he was a big moral authority for this country, someone that Czechoslovakia in particular needed?
Czech society and Czechoslovak society always was and still, unfortunately, is in a grave need of independent minds. And Ludwig Vaculík was a scholar in the terms of independent mind.
If you were to say, name one single thing, what is the most important legacy that he has left us?
I think it's exactly his independence. One could remember the manifesto, 2,000 words that he authored in 1968, or his dissident activities in the 70s and 80s. But I will always remember him for one quote. In 1990, when asked about Charter 77 dissident movement in Czechoslovakia, he said, "Most people will never understand that Charter 77 was a rebellion of a character, of human character, not that of political opinion." And I think that Czech society will miss his brilliant, sharp mind exactly in this term.
Among Ludwig Vaculík's best-known works are The Axe, The Guinea Pigs, The Czech Dream Book and A Cup of Coffee with My Interrogator that established him on the international literary scene. As a journalist, Ludwig Vaculík has written hundreds of essays commenting on every aspect of Czech cultural and political life, which some consider to be his most precious legacy and a valuable document of our times.
Daniela Lazarová with that report. But now Ian Willoughby has the roundup of the latest Czech sports news.
We begin today with tennis and the great success of Lucia Shafashova at the French Open in Paris. Having never previously gotten past the third round in the singles at Roland Garros, the Czech went all the way to Saturday's final against Serena Williams. After losing the first set, Shafashova made a spirited fight back in the second, only to eventually lose 3-6, 7-6, 2-6 to Williams, who claimed her 20th Grand Slam title. Nevertheless, Shafashova had a chance to make amends the very next day in the doubles final, and duly did so, serving out the centre court match as she and Bethany Matek-Sands overcame Casey Delacroix and Yaroslava Shvedova. The Czech's great run in Paris has seen her climb to 7th in the world rankings. With Petra Kvitova second, it's the first time in 25 years that there have been two Czechs in the women's top 10. By coincidence, both are left-handed. But what is behind Shafashova's newfound success? Many have pointed to the positive influence of Rob Steckley, who's been her trainer since late 2013. Among them is the non-playing captain of the Czech Fed Cup team, Petr Pála.
I think working with Rob has been a good fit for her. They've worked on a lot of things together. She believes in herself, which is very important for Lucy's game. She's brought that belief to bear. Also, she hasn't been injured for a long time, which is very important.
Lucia Shafashova has reached such heights at the relatively advanced age of 28, and the challenge now will be to remain at this level.
We will see. Right now, I'm just celebrating what I've done. Then I will have to come to terms with a certain pressure that I've never experienced before. Things have been going gradually. First, I was in the world top 20, and this season I've been defending a lot of points. It's gradually been building up like that. I'm getting used to the new position I find myself in, but for now, everything is positive.
Soccer and the Czech national team have been gathering in Prague ahead of a home Euro 2016 qualifier against Iceland. Much attention has been paid to the future of goalkeeper Petr Čech, who may have played his last game for Chelsea after a season in which he played second fiddle to Thibaut Courtois. However, Čech, who is 33, said he's concentrating on the Iceland game.
I'm focusing on playing the best I can against Iceland. After that, I will sit down with my agent, Viktor Kolar, and consider all the alternatives. We're going to lay all the cards on the table, and I'll choose whatever option is most attractive to me. All the speculation doesn't interest me. I know myself how things stand. When everything becomes clear, things will be calmer.
Finally, Athletics and Vítězslav Veselý was the best of the Czechs at a Diamond League meeting in Birmingham in the UK at the weekend. Veselý came second in the javelin, beaten only by Julius Yego of Kenya, who achieved the longest throw in Diamond League history with 91.39 metres. That's all the sport for today.
Thank you, Ian Willoughby, for that. Just a reminder that you are listening to Radio Prague, the international service of Czech radio. Coming up next, the Czech national revival of the 18th and 19th centuries was aimed at reviving Czech language and culture. However, two manuscripts used to bolster the idea of Czech national identity at the time turned out to be faked. U.S. academic David Cooper is an expert on the hoax texts and is Ian Willoughby's guest in this edition of One on One.
The Green Mountain Manuscript and the Queen's Court Manuscript were important texts in the Czech national revival of the 19th century, helping to underpin burgeoning national consciousness and becoming part of the broader culture. However, the compendiums of Czech legends and folklore turned out to be forgeries. David Cooper of the University of Illinois is currently in Prague doing research into and translating the manuscripts. He discussed them on a visit to our studios last week.
The Queen's Court manuscript and the Green Mountain manuscript are medieval manuscripts, or they're made to look like medieval manuscripts, and they contain poetic texts. The biggest one is the Queen's Court manuscript. It has six epic poems that tell, that relate historical events, historical battles, some of which are historical, some of which are not really historical. The Green Mountain Manuscript was just a single poetic text. It's an epic text. The first manuscript, by its appearance, looks like it comes from the 13th century. The Green Mountain Manuscript, by its appearance, looks like it comes from somewhere around the 9th century, so really, really quite early. And it contains an account of the legendary Libuche holding court for a dispute between two brothers over their father's inheritance and sort of what comes out of that. So this is a story that's known also from Czech chronicles, but this is sort of a unique account of it then.
What was the purpose of these texts?
This was a moment in European literature when everyone was rediscovering their medieval roots of their literature. As they're sort of breaking away from dependence on classical models, they're looking to their own native traditions for new models, for new ways of advancing literature going forward. And to go forward, they often look to the past. And so this is a period when the French rediscovered the Song of Roland, when some years later the Beowulf was discovered again, the Song of Cid for Spain, and so on. And of course, the Germans had discovered the Nibelungen song. And the Czechs were looking in their manuscript traditions, looking for similar kinds of material, and they weren't finding it. The feeling was that it certainly had to exist, because every other European nation that had a literature, and the Czechs had a literature already from the 14th century, that had begun in this kind of epic tradition, singing historical heroic songs. And when they didn't find it, they figured either it was burnt during the Hussite Wars, right, when a lot of Czech manuscripts were burnt, or during the Counter-Reformation in the 17th and 18th century, also when Czech manuscripts were took heavy losses. So the idea was that they certainly had it, but that it somehow was lost. And so it was an attempt really to recreate it. And it has to do with the cultural competition with the German speakers also in Bohemia.
This was during the Czech National Revival.
Yes. Yeah, so this is the second decade of the 19th century. The Czech national movement is just starting to develop some momentum. People are signing on to it. They want to do work to develop Czech nationality, and they really need this. The feeling is, and the sort of the understanding of national literature at this point is, that they really need something like this as a base, as a ground, in order to go forward.
And when these evidently false texts were discovered or disseminated, what was the impact?
The two manuscripts really had quite different fates, because the first one that was discovered was the Queen's Court manuscript, and it was never in question, really. People accepted it as authentic, and it wasn't really until the 1870s that you started to get serious questions about its authenticity. And the reason you started to get questions about its authenticity was because of the second manuscript, which was in doubt really right from the very beginning. 9th century Czech writing, Czech poetic traditions, this is at least 3 centuries earlier than anything they'd seen before. So it was immediately suspicious. And Josef Dobrovský, who was one of the spiritual founders of the Czech National Revival, said immediately, it's a fake, it comes from my students, they're the only ones who know old Czech well enough to fake it, right?
And so the counterfeiters went too far.
They went too far, yes. Essentially, they went too far. The thing is though, that the Czech patriots embraced the second manuscript as well. They defended it against Dobrovský and other skeptics, and they held the two manuscripts together really as almost kind of sacred texts for the Czech national revival. One of the things that I'm interested in and that I'm looking at is a sort of quasi-religious faith in the manuscripts. To be a Czech patriot, in some sense, meant to believe in the authenticity of both of the manuscripts.
And the Green Mountain manuscript found its way into the broader culture.
Yes, it did. For example, if you go to the National Theater and the lobby on the second floor, on the ceiling there's a painting of Libuche sitting in court. She's sitting on a golden throne. The idea of Libuche's golden throne, her father's golden throne. This is a phrase that is repeated. It's sort of a mantra in the Green Mountain manuscript. The depiction of Libuche there in the National Theater, which was, of course, constructed in the late 19th century, at a moment when the controversy was already starting about the authenticity of the manuscripts, comes from the manuscripts, essentially.
How and why was the falsification discovered in this case?
It happens at a moment when Prague University is undergoing a kind of crisis. It splits into a German faculty and a Czech faculty. And the young scholars in the Czech faculty need to establish themselves, need to establish their legitimacy. And one of them Jan Gebauer, who's a historical linguist, has been working on the manuscripts for some time, has been a defender of their authenticity, but he's starting to have doubts. There's starting to be too many exceptions they have to make in the nature of Old Czech for these manuscripts. It's starting to become clear to him that they don't fit in, that their language doesn't fit into the historical development of Czech. And so it's really Gebauer in the lead, although the organizer of the I don't want to say attack on the manuscripts, but the campaign against the authenticity of the manuscripts was led by the future first president of Czechoslovakia, Tomáš Masaryk.
And Masaryk got a lot of abuse for his stance on the issue.
Yes, he did. And he and Gebauer and the other scholars who were involved in writing these articles, laying out the evidence for the falsification of the manuscripts, they were called national traitors. These manuscripts had so sort of become part of what it meant to be a Czech patriot and so much a part of Czech national mythology that to call them false was seen as a serious betrayal. And Gebauer, for example, for at least 10 years had terrible problems getting any of his scholarly work published. The journal that initially published the articles had to step away from it. They had to find new ways of publishing it. Masaryk had to find financial support in order to get it published. They were really persona non grata for a while in Czech patriotic circles.
If I understand it right, you believe that these texts, even though false, still benefited the Czech nation.
I do, yeah. And I think that's the direction that the research is going on these manuscripts these days. It's really actually since a couple decades after they were shown to be false that the manuscripts sort of came back into the study of Czech literature as examples of Czech poetry from the early 19th century. So if you do a study of how Czech poetry develops, the manuscripts were included. What weren't included were the people suspected of being their authors, right? Because they were forgers, they were falsifiers. And so the usual suspects, Václav Hanka, Josef Linda, you don't find books written about them. You don't find studies of their other writing because they've been pushed out. And so one of the things that's happening is a recognition that this is some of the most influential poetry of the first half of the 19th century. It was the most translated work of Czech literature for most of the 19th century into other languages. And so the author certainly deserves some credit for that rather than exile, essentially, right?
And you are translating them again now.
I am. Yeah, the first translation was done. There were some interesting contexts in the first half of the 19th century between England and Bohemia. There was a Slavist, John Bowring, who published the very first ever anthology of Czech literature in English, and he included in that several of the songs from these manuscripts, as well as some other mystifications, literature that pretended to be things that it wasn't. And there was another translator, and I never gotten the first name, it's A. Vratislav, who was a second-generation immigrant to England who had studied at Cambridge, and he produced a translation also of the entire manuscripts. But both of these translations were done in the 1840s, and they have they've aged a little bit. Vratislav also was fond of rhyme and used rhyme in the epic poems, which really doesn't belong in epic poems, and the Czech, the poems from the manuscripts were sort of programmatically unrhymed. The idea was that rhyme came to Czech culture from German culture, which isn't true, but it came along with Christian culture, and so the idea was that if you want to get back to authentic, original Slavic Czech poetry, it's certainly unrhymed.
As well as working on these translations, you're also writing a book about unresolved issues surrounding the manuscripts. What are those unresolved issues?
One of the main issues still remains authorship. They've never found any direct evidence of participation in the creation of the manuscripts. There's primarily indirect evidence. They've never found, you know, drafts or correspondence. These were the conspirators were apparently quite careful.
There's no smoking gun.
There's no smoking gun. No, but there is a lot of evidence though in terms of the types of things that the people who were probably involved wrote elsewhere that connect pretty clearly to the way that the manuscripts were composed. Also, just I think thinking about the idea of authorship in the Romantic period and the role that forgery plays in that, sort of newer perspectives on this that have also been worked out in the study of English literature in connection with the forgeries of Macpherson, the Ossian poems. This needs to be thought through again in Czech literature, and if we're going to rehabilitate the authors of these poems, to see forgery as a romantic form of creativity rather than as a trespass against creativity.
My impression is that the word mystification is much more common in Czech than in English. Czechs, it seems to me, have a kind of sympathy with mystification. Would you agree?
I would agree, right? And in fact, there's even a kind of national pride that we're a nation of mystifiers or mystificators, right? And there's, you know, they've sort of done an amazing job of cataloging the kinds of mystifications that are very much a part of Czech literary practice in the 19th and into the in the 20th century as well. I think the fact is that it's not more prominent a practice in Czech literature. The Czechs, I think, are more aware of it. And I think part of the reason they're more aware of it is this whole episode with the forged manuscripts in the 19th century, right? And a lot of Czechs embrace this playful aspect of Czech culture and this idea that we can have fun making things up and not have that be damaging.
You're a specialist in literary forgeries. What's the attraction of that area?
Partly, I think, is that the sort of the taboo of it, right? And the opportunity to sort of open up that taboo. Look at why forgery was so long considered to be a kind of literary crime. And if you go back and look at the medieval period, forgery has a different feel and a different morality about it. Forgery has always been a very common practice, and there are periods in which forgery was a sort of a celebrated method, and it was often a necessary method in order for culture to be able to sort of replicate itself and to advance itself. The paradox is the Romantic period, the early 19th century, both sort of invites forgery, demands forgery. Forgeries are prevalent in the period. At the same time, it's this period that creates this idea of the original work, right, and the original authorial genius that's creating sort of out of nothing. That's not really how creativity works. And so forgery is one of these supplements that's necessary in the period. But when people start to worry about authenticity, which is also a big romantic value, and originality, forgeries look like the biggest transgression against that. Right, so it's interesting, and one of the paradoxes that I'm exploring is the fact that this romantic period both sort of pushes forward the method of forgery and makes it quite common, but also creates the values that make it illicit.
David Cooper of the University of Illinois was speaking to Ian Willoughby in this week's edition of One on One. And that brings us to the end of our English language broadcast. If you have any comments about today's program, then please send them to us. You can contact us by email at english@radio.cz or on Facebook and Twitter. We'll be glad to hear from you. But that's all for now from me, Ruth Franková. Thank you very much for joining us, and goodbye.